Welcome back to Campbell Conversations with your host, Colin Campbell, and today is episode 236 of the podcast, and I'm joined in conversation by Adam Rossi. Adam is an Inc. 500 entrepreneur, engineer, business owner, and investor. As the founder of Platinum Solutions, Adam and his wife Lila grew their business to a multi-million dollar company before they successfully sold and exited. You can expect to learn about the drawbacks of medicating lively children or blunting your desire and drive with recreational drugs, what the early days of growing a tech business looked like back in the late 90s and early 2000s, novel ways to pay the bills, fund your business and win contracts, what it was like working with the FBI and CIA, and why entrepreneurship is a team sport. Beyond this, you're going to understand what investors look for in successful companies and Adam's advice to founders on health, business, and family. It's only in recent years that Adam has started to share online, and I'm very, very glad that he has. He has a tremendous amount of wisdom to share, and I loved understanding his perspectives as somebody who's achieved so much in the business world to now come onto the online space and share that and impart that on us is so, so important. So the next generation of founders, entrepreneurs, and aspirational people are going to really benefit from this conversation. If you want to unlock the power of podcasting and grow your own personal brand, your network, and your business, then my podcast masterclass is for you. I have built the perfect learning platform for you to build, start, scale, and sustain your own podcast using my systems, my processes, the best way to get the guests on in your niche that you would like, to record like a pro and host and ask great questions, and how to market and distribute it to the maximum number of eyes and ears. The link will be in the show notes to join my podcast masterclass, and that is www.mypodcastmasterclass.thinkific.com. If you have the desire to get out there and create a podcast and really benefit downstream from it, then I've got that set up and ready for you. Last thing to say before we dive into this episode with Adam is please make sure you've hit that follow or subscribe button wherever you're listening. It's a huge support for the show, and hopefully you're appreciating the fact that we're hitting those double episodes every Sunday, every Wednesday. It is not easy, but we are in a great position, and I'm so grateful for the support of you guys as an audience who keep sharing it to your Instagram stories, to your LinkedIn feeds, or passing on to friends direct via message. It does not go unnoticed, and we are flying in the right direction, and I'm going to keep having wonderful conversations like this one with Mr. Adam Rossi. Adam, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Colin.
And when I was thinking about where to get started with this conversation, there were so many different opportunities and options, but I've been going quite deep on your content, and I decided to pick a tweet that you sent out in November 2023. And that tweet was as follows. I'm quite certain that if behavioral meds were existing back then, they would have been recommended for me. Fortunately, I'm 50 years old, and when I was a kid, these meds didn't even exist. I'm fairly confident I would not have had the life that I do now without the drive and the fire that pushed me through dark decades. I'm not saying I'm perfect, but I generally like the way that my brain works. I still struggle with anger. I still struggle with anxiety, but I'm always striving to be better. What prompted you to write that, Adam?
So what prompted me to write that is I have three kids, an 18-year-old son, a 13-year-old son, and a 16-year-old daughter. And for both my sons, at some point in their kind of elementary school years, the teachers would say, look, there's some issues with, you know, attention and kind of defiance, and have you considered medication for them? And so, you know, it's one of those things where almost everyone I know with sons, it seems to be more, you know, the kind of young boy thing. You get this talk and, you know, talking to a doctor, they're kind of like, we'll prescribe it after a 30-minute, you know, conversation. Like we'll prescribe that. And for me and my wife, it was just like, whoa, wait a second. You know, like this is a major decision, you know, like beyond just, you know, but the behavior that the people were mentioning wasn't what I would consider out of the norm for a boy, and was, quite frankly, much better than my behavior when I was in elementary school. And, you know, so I was just, you know, I mean, my elementary school, the first day my mother was called and told, you know, come collect your son. He's not ready for school. He's kicked a teacher. And at one point, I was making straight A's in classes that I cared about, like the science class, math class, and making horrible grades in the other classes. And the teachers at my school said he needs to go. We didn't have kind of drug interventions, but they said he needs to go to a specialist to be tested. Like, he may be mentally deficient, you know? And so my mother brought me to a local college and they gave me an IQ test. And they're like, he's not mentally deficient. He just doesn't want to do this stuff. So he's defiant, you know? And I can list a bunch of other things that were, you know, really bad behaviors, right? Fighting, not listening to teachers. And so when it was brought up for my sons, I was kind of like, you know, one, I didn't think their behavior was out of the norm for a young boy. And two, it made me think back that with all the stuff that I had going on, my mother would have had a really hard push to put me on some type of medication. And from what I've seen, people stay on those medications, maybe all the way through adulthood. And it scares me to think about what the ramifications from that one decision would be. And not to, you know, I know plenty of parents, you know, maybe listening to this saying, hey, you know, for my child, it's made a big difference. I'm sure that's the case for the right person. My thing is just, I'm glad I wasn't put on it. I didn't allow my kids to be put on it because I think the threshold for a lot of people to prescribe these is too low.
That's a key consideration. The threshold has lowered over time. And if you look at how you behaved as a kid, you're absolutely right. The way the medical system is now and some of the incentives around it in particular, but also just the nature of what we perceive in society as acceptable non-boisterous behavior, because like a term that sprung to mind we do was boisterous, a bit lively, maybe a slight temper that would spill over. You mentioned anger, anxiety, drive, and fire. These are very similar behaviors, but in slightly different realms. So the drive and fire that you turn towards entrepreneurship and building all these amazing companies that you've pursued, that's something that if it had been dulled at a younger age, that's a real concern. And you're reflecting almost like what came to pass might not have been the case if I chose to, and the word I will use is sedate myself at a younger age with some of these medications, because that's sometimes what the teachers and the doctors are seeking. They're seeking a relatively easy life by dialing down some of the things that are potentially intimidating them about a child's behavior.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, one of the things that I have had in my life ever since I was a kid was almost this like burning desire to accomplish something, a feeling of like a drive that almost caused like anxiety all the time of like, what am I doing to get ready? I want to leave, you know, the area I'm growing up. I want to start a company. I don't know what the company is going to be, but it really was like a fire. Like I would lay awake at night and think about like, what are the things I need to do? And it's another reason why I talk to a lot of young people. I coach basketball, you know, scout leader, do an internship program for kids in DC. It's another thing I say about pot, you know, is just, I know too many young people who kind of dull themselves, not with a prescription medication, but with something like marijuana, where they're waking up in the morning, they're smoking, and then the rest of the day, they're just kind of like on a 4 instead of a 9. And, you know, I worry so much that if your brain does have that kind of working against you, I don't know a lot of successful people that could have been successful if they were kind of operating with like an arm tied behind their back like that.
Arm tied behind the back is a really powerful phrase, isn't it? Because some of those behaviors which are deemed problematic or challenging are exactly what are required for the levels of massive success, and for you to turn some of that anxiety about almost that itch to be like, look, I need to create something, I need to build something, I need to do something different. If that was dulled, then you do become institutionalized within the school system and you maybe drift through life in a way that's really negative, and listeners will laugh down their AirPods or through the car stereo. I talk about living life on autopilot all the time, and it's really easy to be comfortably numb, whether that's through prescribed medication or whether that's through sedating yourself with something like marijuana. You do lose that element of get up and go, which is so vital to achieve something which the average person isn't achieving. And if you choose to listen to a self-development podcast, or this one, once or twice a week, you're probably not the average person, but you can have habits which will put you into the average person bracket and limit you from achieving some of the things that the people I get to speak to have done.
Yeah, I boil it down to you have to have that kind of fire that makes the status quo not feel good, right? Like if the status quo feels safe and good, you don't grow, you don't develop, you don't do anything else. You just kind of live that way. And I know people in my life that have had amazing potential, much smarter than me, you know, much more capable, but they got comfortable early on in this kind of status quo that this is good enough and they never got out of it. And I think, you know, there's a lot of things that can happen to you other than, you know, things like drug dependency. You know, there's also just, you know, kind of self-defeatist thinking or limited thinking or just all these other things. But I felt a burning that the status quo was not acceptable forever, you know, like it was a major motivator.
Yeah, I completely agree. And just on the marijuana piece, I think it's interesting because many people talk about it not being addictive, and that might well be the case, but it can be habitual. And that is, if it's used on regular occasions, you know that it becomes part of your routine, whether that's to help you get to sleep, albeit there's a lot of data that shows it actually doesn't get into high quality REM sleep or deep sleep, so it's not really recharging you. But it's also sometimes like blunting your ability to go and do the thing that you thought was hard. So instead of maybe going in training, or instead of maybe spending that hour reading or doing deep work for the company that you want to build or the side hustle you're trying to progress in or the skill that you want to level up within your career, you smoke that joint and you watch something entertaining, or you fall down the rabbit hole on TikTok or whatever it is, and you never go and do the thing. And that can often be like a gateway to inactivity, rather than if you just stay away from the comfort and the sedation of these methods, you sit in the anxiety and the fear and the drive to do something different. And that's when action takes place, because you want to get out of that state, but you're not going to do it through short-term pleasure.
Yeah, it's exactly right. And I worry that, you know, now that it's become kind of legalized or decriminalized in DC, for example, see a ton of young people smoking pot on like the sidewalk when you're just, you know, if you go to like a Wizards game, everybody's smoking. And I think they're getting the message that it's not that bad, you know? And to your point, I know a lot of people that are not physically addicted, but if you have to smoke when you wake up in the morning and when you go to bed at night, I'd say you're still addicted. You're psychologically addicted, and it has a hold on you, and it's not conductive. I mean, I really don't know anyone that's like started a company or become a successful entrepreneur that was doing things like that. Because just it's too hard to fight through.
It's a limitation that you don't need. It's a handicap.
Yep.
You had this burning desire. When did the idea for Platinum Solutions start?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm fortunate that my grandfather and father both owned construction companies. One was a highway construction company. One was a general construction company. And then my father also started a precast concrete plant. And so for me, ever since I was a little kid, kind of the norm in my family was you start a business, right? It's kind of the opposite of a lot of people's kind of home environment. And so I was always just drawing kind of trademarks and thinking about company names, and I had no idea what I was going to do. So I left home at 17, went to Virginia Tech and got an engineering degree, because I felt like it would give me the most optionality to figure something out. And as I was doing that, I really, really became interested in software. And I wrote a computer program that would design concrete steel reinforced concrete retaining walls. And it was a bunch of books. I still have these books on my bookshelf, but it used to be like big steel manuals, concrete manuals. You'd have to look up all these tables. So I wrote a program that would design it for you if you give the inputs, and it caught on. You know, a lot of professional engineers were like, I want to buy this. You know, this is a super productivity enhancer. And so I was like, okay, there it is. Like, I'm going to start a software company that does engineering tool development. And, you know, I just said, I'll go to work for 2 years. And then I that was my time limit. And then I'm going to start this company. And so that was my original kind of idea. I mean, Platinum Solutions turned into a company that was focused on a completely different software niche, but that was at least my going in plan.
What led to you pivoting to doing something different with Quantum Solutions than the original plan?
Yeah, so when I started Platinum Solutions, I was the only employee. My wife was working at Anderson Consulting, was paying the bills to kind of keep the company going, or keep us going. And I sat at the kitchen table and I was writing these software programs for engineering design. And I didn't really have a way to advertise or market or do customer acquisition. Like, the internet was still very young. This was 1999. And so I started writing programming articles in print software journals to kind of get my name and company name out there. And I started to present at software conferences. And after one software conference, this guy came up to me and said, "Hey, you're in the DC area. We have this project at the FBI that's kind of going south. Would you come take a look at it?" And I said, "Sure." And so I went in, and they had a 2-year deadline. They were 1.5 years in. And when I looked at kind of what they were doing, I was just like, this isn't going to work. You've kind of went down the wrong path here, and this can't scale. It can't do the things you want. So I said, if you hire me, I've got just enough time. Me personally, I'll work night and day for 6 months, and we'll deliver this for you. And so that's what I did. And I rewrote it, delivered it. It was a evidence kind of collection system. And then I was like, I want nothing more to do with you all, because this was a very dysfunctional kind of way to manage a project. And so I split, you know, I kept going back to doing what I was doing, started to work for a lot of .com startups. So this was 99, 2000. And then 9/11 happened, and it was this big shock, you know, totally shocking. And I happened to be, you know, a week or two later in a bagel shop in Tyson's Corner. And this guy came up to me and he said, "Hey, are you Adam Rossi?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Yeah, my manager's been looking for you. He really needs to talk to you about this other project we have, because, you know, you're the one who rewrote the evidence system. Would you come talk to him?" And I was hesitant even then. I was like, I didn't have a great experience with you guys, but I did. Went in, and they said, "Look, it's all hands on deck. You don't have a security clearance. Your company doesn't have a facility clearance. You don't have the things you technically need, but we're going to kind of bend some rules, clear you as though you're an employee. Then we'll get you your facility clearance, and we'll kind of, you know, fix the paperwork for that. But we need you to work on this new thing. And if you hire people, we need to get them cleared to work on this new thing too." So that was it. I wish I could say it was like a strategic pivot, or that I had any planning or foresight, but it was kind of chance occurrence.
But ultimately, you were in a position to take advantage of that because of the skill set that you had and the job that you'd probably done on that first project for the FBI. You'd maybe given them reassurance that you were somebody that was an expert in your field, particularly at a time when there wasn't that level, that number of companies maybe potentially doing that as well. And while you maybe don't give yourself credit for like going out and seeking it and almost wanting to not deal with the FBI to an extent, and like I split and I would work with .com companies, etc. But when they came back round, there was a reason they chose you and they chose Platinum Solutions that maybe wasn't apparently obvious at the time, but clearly it was.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you I worked my butt off on that first project, right? I mean, I was, and this was true for the beginning years of my company, I would, you know, hold one eye open while I was typing with the other hand, because I was working 24 hours, sometimes, you know, multiple days without sleep. I'm, you know, my eyes are forcing shut and I'm propping them open. I would listen to late night radio, and they would have like Ozzy Osbourne tickets for like the first caller. And I would win a bunch of tickets and then just never get them, because it was like no one else was awake at like 3 a.m., you know? So I was like a one man, like I was on a mission. Like, this is my company. This is my reputation. I have to do a good job. And so, yeah, I, you know, I feel very proud of what I did on our first project with the FBI. And, you know, I think when they were able to extend to me kind of some special, favors to get my company kind of with the foundation that it needed, you know, I think it was in recognition of the fact that they knew they would get someone that was going to give it everything they had for them.
Yeah. I think when I reflect on the things that I've learned about you, Adam, through your Twitter and your LinkedIn in particular, those early days were particularly tough from a financial perspective. And when you get an opportunity like with the FBI, it makes total sense that you should really go all in, because while it's not a golden ticket, it is a gateway to one, credibility with a really valuable organization. But off the back of that, I guess you can't really shout about it, but at least you have real social proof of a client that has put ultimate trust in you to manage something through, which is really important. But let's go back to some of those early days and the kind of financial rigmarole, because you've shared before that you and your wife actually had negative net worths because of the student loan debt that you owned at the time.
Yep, we did not have a pot to piss in. So, you know, I met my wife in business school, and when we graduated, we got married. And so we both had similar debt. We both owed $35,000. So collectively, you know, $70,000 in the hole. Neither one of us had families that could afford to loan us, you know, money for a new business. So, you know, during that 2 years that I mentioned that we were both working, you know, I think my starting salary, I worked for Coopers and Lybrand doing software development and cybersecurity. I think my starting salary was $35,000. And so we rented kind of the crummiest apartment in the area. We drove our beater cars from college during this time. And we managed in the 2 years to save $30,000 while paying down those loans. I mean, it would take years to pay them all the way off. But so that's what we used to start the company. It was $30,000. And, you know, we talked to banks and they just like laughed us out. They were like, we're not going to lend you anything. Like, this is a brand new company. Fundraising back in that time wasn't as easy as it is now. And I can also say one of the major differences in 99 versus today is starting a company or entrepreneurship wasn't exactly encouraged or celebrated, kind of like it is now. So we had a lot of people telling us, don't do this, you know? And so it wasn't easy to ask people for money. It'd be like, I don't think you should quit your job. You have a good job. Like, you know, that would be the response. So
yeah, you were at one of the big four, and I can only imagine that you were doing a good job in those initial 2 years, but you had that 2 year timeline in your head. You said that after that, I want to go and do my own thing. This logo I've been drawing since second grade.
Exactly. And it was, yeah, it's like a promise I made to myself. And I would always write down goals and promises, you know, and I'm not going to deviate from this. And when it came time to give my notice, I walked into the partner and I said, I'm giving my notice. And he said, why? And I said, I'm starting a company. And he was just like, I think it's a major mistake. And it was uncomfortable for me too, because you can easily just say, yeah, I could work here 10 years. I could become a partner, maybe, you know, prestigious, good pay. It felt scary and horrible. You know, I felt like I wanted to puke when I was given my notice. And part of the reason too was, you know, you have to tell everyone. Everyone's like, you just quit your job. What are you going to do? It's like, well, I'm starting a company. And I was horrified that I'm going to have to tell those people it didn't work and I'll be embarrassed or humiliated. So yeah, part of it was just the financial risk. And part of it was what I perceived to be reputational risk to do it. It was really scary, and we had super dark days for the first few years.
When you're unable to get lending from the bank and you have just 30,000, I don't know what the startup costs were in your space, but the running costs, I imagine, are beyond £30,000 over a period of time until you're really fully at full tilt with a full roster of clients. What are those early days like from a financial perspective?
Yeah. So when it was just me, it was manageable because I could just not pay myself, right? And so Lila was making, you know, $35,000-$40,000, and we could live on that. But when we started to hire employees, you know, you have that payroll every 2 weeks, and it's, you can't miss it. You know, if you miss payroll, people quit, people freak out. And so, we had a period of like 6 months where one customer was just not paying their invoices, and they were just saying, we'll pay it. You know, it'll, you know, next month we'll take care of the open invoices. And I'm paying payroll from that, you know, saved $30,000, and it runs out. And the only thing we could think to do was American Express had sent 5 or 6 paper checks that are used to pay off your balance on other credit cards if you wanted to consolidate your credit cards onto American Express. I was like, I don't know if this is going to work, but I wrote one of the checks to my company, and I deposited it in the bank, and it cleared, and I made payroll with that. And, you know, it was so scary that Lila and I were like walking through the supermarket one night, and I don't know what we were talking about, work, and we both just kind of stopped and like hugged each other in the aisle. It's like, is this going to work? Like, we're now like so far beyond negative, we're using like credit card checks to make payroll. Like, it was super scary. And it was just like, okay, the only way forward is forward. You know, we just have to make this work.
What gives you a level of reassurance to keep going forward at that point?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the major things I was worried about at the time was I had seen people try something entrepreneurial and fail, and then they became very risk averse and never did it again, never tried it again. And one of the things I was worried about is, you know, if I have to pull the plug on this company, you know, I'll feel shame. You know, we'll have lost all of our saved money. Will I then become too conservative and you know, unsure of myself to do it again? And so that was one of my major motivations. I would also say I was horrified about declaring bankruptcy. I kind of feel differently about it now, in that we didn't have kids. We didn't have big, you know, expenses. We didn't have car notes or a fancy house mortgage. And so I think just my conservative nature financially kind of caused me to feel a lot more stress about it than maybe I should have. Like declaring bankruptcy when you don't really owe much of anything is not that big a deal, but it was scary to us at the time. And then I just believed that, you know, I kept seeing this like future company where we had, you know, amazing products, and we had a large organization, and, you know, I could see it out there. I knew that like we have to get through the brambles here, and it's kind of right over there in that clearing. So those are all kind of motivators, I think, that just kept pushing
you forward. I think it's funny, that fear of, if this fails, I'll end up doing a normal conservative with a small C job or role, is a funny situation, because you hear many entrepreneurs talk about their first failure or their second failure and what it taught them and what they moved on to. But from your self-awareness, you were like, if I fail, I probably don't want to do this again. So I need to kind of full steam ahead towards this current idea and this one idea that I'm going to back all in.
Yeah, I think that's something that's really helpful now for entrepreneurs. You know, there's all these stories about people who had first failure, second failure, third failure, and then had this amazing success. And we've kind of become more tolerant of that, I think, as a society. And, you know, your friends and family, it's kind of like, okay, you know, you can try again. Where, you know, even at the time in 99, I mean, the word entrepreneurship was not normalized. I think the attitude of society was much more conservative about that. And so I think it's great now that people are not deathly afraid to fail, because I hear even people who had their first major success like in their 50s, 60s, you know, they've and it goes on to be like this huge success. I think that's really cool. I mean, I'm very fortunate that the first real company I founded was a success. I think that's more unusual now than the norm. So yeah, I think it's very cool when I mentor a lot of young, you know, founders, entrepreneurs, they have a lower degree of anxiety about like this first thing must work or, you know, I'm sunk.
It's probably one of the upsides of the internet. And we were speaking earlier about sedation through prescription drugs or marijuana recreationally. One of the things the internet can do is it can stimulate or it can sedate. And if you're a young guy or a young girl and you're seeing this content about somebody bouncing back from an entrepreneurial failure or learning the lesson of a challenging experience they had and rescuing the company or making payroll through like challenging means and then going on to build again. And many of the guests I've had on the show have spoken about just that experience. That's available to you on the internet, or you could watch hours of TikTok or Reels or porn or whatever your vice is and sedate yourself from pursuing these goals. So there's like a bit of give and take. So in contrast to 1999, the word entrepreneur is available to you, but doesn't necessarily mean that everyone is using that opportunity available to them to pursue it.
Yeah, I mean, it really is a like a Pandora's box now, in that there's, you know, it's whatever you want it to be. You can, the resources that are available to learn are amazing. I mean, when I taught myself programming, when I was in school, we were using Fortran, which was kind of an outdated language even at the time we were learning it. So I had to learn Java and C, C++. And I was, you know, I was buying hardcover books that were like this thick. I was reading them on the train in the morning. And I would then just kind of think about the code I would write because I didn't have a laptop, you know, it was like there's a desktop somewhere else. For something like that, learning programming now for a young person, I mean, Udemy classes, the, you know, ChatGPT to help you, you know, understand the concept. I mean, like, it is amazing. But, you know, the downside, of course, is you can waste your entire day just browsing stupid stuff. And, you know, so for young people that are motivated, I think this is an absolute golden age. I mean, a golden age. But you're right. Like, you just have to be, you know, there's an expression I really like. I don't know who said it. But the, you know, the expression is you are what you think about all day long. And I tell my kids that all the time. Like, if you put, you know, junk into your mind, that's what you think about. You know, you, it's like a reinforcing loop. And if you think about positive, constructive, growth kind of oriented things, your brain is like an amazing, you know, the most amazing device in creation. It will generate those things. So
self-fulfilling prophecies become true. You're constantly yep. feeding it with the right stuff and you're going to move forward in the right direction. I completely agree. And when you're talking about those days where you're propping your eyelids open and working on code and working on programming and just grafting and grafting and grafting, that is only really possible for a short period of time. And I know you've reminisced before about like that kind of golden period where there's less responsibility and more opportunity to build something that requires that level of like monumental effort.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a reason why you see people like, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, you know, have these major successes in their 20s. You know, now that I'm 50 years old, I have a new appreciation for the superhuman capabilities that you have in your 20s and 30s. You know, in that your need for kind of rest and sleep is less than when you get older. Your just ability to focus on things, you don't have as many distractions with, you know, large families or even financial distractions like big mortgages and things like that you're worried about. And so, you know, I'm one of these people that feels like if you can figure out something that you're passionate in those kind of golden decades and either learn it or found a company in it or become an expert in it, you have just like, you really have such amazing powers during that time in your life. Not that, you know, it goes away later, but I just feel like, you know, there's a trend right now, and I don't know why, where people are maturing much later than when I was growing up and living at home and not having their first, you know, girlfriend, not having their first real job. Like, it's getting pushed into the future for a lot of folks. And I think it maybe is a detriment because they're missing out on some of those really, really kind of fiery, energized times in their life if they were working towards something more concrete.
I would use the term developmental experiences. A lot of them are being pushed back further. And there's an element of mollycoddling further and further down the line. So when the time does come to fly the nest, to use an animalistic term, it can sometimes feel even more fearful because you've had even longer staying in that area of comfort. And I completely agree, and while there's content like this that encourages people to embrace their fears, step outside the comfort zone and push forward, a lot of content is also encouraging people to, you're fine as you are, you're great, it's okay to not be okay, or whatever the kind of tag phrases are that tell people to sit within their current state and almost embrace it. And that's something that I would rally against quite strongly.
Yeah, I do see a lot of that content as well, right? Where, you know, it's when I left home, I was 17 and I was kind of like, I'm never coming back home. Like, this is like, I'm out in the world and I'm going to make something happen. You know, looking at some of the people that I coach and mentor, to me, it's really like, you know, if your first kind of, you know, experience with the opposite sex is much later, if your first, like, you know, like the expectation of marriage is much later now, you know, it's to me, you know, it reaches a point where it becomes really sad, because I think, you know, when you talk to people that are older, like myself, if you talk to my wife and I, we would say we waited too long to have kids. So we got married when we were 24. We started our company. And then we were working really hard, and we kind of put off kids, not too late, but, you know, a little bit later, like now in retrospect, be like, you know what? I wish I had those kids like 3 or 4 years earlier, you know? And, you know, as a 50-year-old with my youngest being a 13-year-old, it's not like, you know, it's egregious, but, you know, I know a lot of people now that are, you know, having their first child kind of much later in life. And just, I don't know, the whole, I don't want to say that I advocate like young people just work like a demon, like I did, you know, and just like, cause it's really hard to sustain that, and it can have a major impact on your health, but I don't want them to put off these things too long, you know?
So as ever, there's a balance to be struck in that regard. But you mentioned there about you and your wife went into business together. And I interviewed a gentleman called Daniel Priestley before Christmas, and I was over in Dubai, and we had a great conversation about entrepreneurship. And he used the phrase that entrepreneurship is a team sport. And I think, and we're speaking about some of the content that's out there, while it's positive that's encouraging entrepreneurship, sometimes there's a lot of that solopreneur focus, whereas you've gone into business not only with somebody else, but actually a loved one from that perspective as well. What was that balance like?
So I don't know that I could have ever been successful just as a solo entrepreneur. I mean, it is all consuming, you know, and it's so hard. I think it would be so hard to do it alone. And so, you know, I not only had an amazingly supportive wife, amazingly supportive, but she, you know, after the first kind of 2 years the company got started, she quit her job, joined the company, and really took over and professionalized the operational running of the company. And I kind of was not doing a great job at that, and I kind of shifted over to being at the client sites, meeting with partners, you know, kind of a lot of the, you know, marketing and kind of outward facing function. And so we had, I was essentially working with my wife, but also someone who I could trust 100% as a business partner. I know a lot of people, and I've had, you know, my grandfather's company fell apart. He was partnered with a couple of his brothers. So they're related, but they didn't have a strong degree of trust, and they ended up kind of fighting and destroying their own company. And I've mentored plenty of people who go into business with like three friends, and usually like one of those friends like doesn't work out, you know, they just can't kind of pull their weight. And so to have someone that you can trust 100% as a partner is so special and rare that, I was like amazingly blessed to work with my wife. And so I hear people say like, oh, you should never work with your wife. But I know plenty of husband and wife teams that have killed it in business together. If you have a great relationship, right? Then it, I think it works really well.
The interesting thing that you've commented on right at the start there was about dovetailing between the different types of activities that you both excelled in and understanding mm-hmm. what areas you can be the most skilled in and the areas that your wife contributes the most strongly in. And Daniel, again, it's funny when what he's spoken about comes into reality. There is often in an entrepreneurial partnership, somebody that is the client facing, the sales, the marketing, mm-hmm. quite often the creative. And then you have somebody that is a little bit more process, operational, mm-hmm. and really covers that back end that enables the person out the front to make promises that can actually be fulfilled. They're not cashing checks that they can't back up. And that's really important to understand those different dynamics between people, because sometimes people immediately associate the entrepreneur with the guy with the jazz hands selling the concept and making it happen. But ultimately, there needs to be people involved that cover those bases, that ensure that what that person has been talking about and getting people excited, enthusiastic about and bring them on the journey actually comes to fruition in the way that it's been sold or promised. And it's interesting that you immediately recognized after those 2 years, well, guess what? Our back end and our operations suddenly started looking a little bit more professional because your wife was able to do that.
It's exactly right. I mean, what really happened was when we started hiring more people, I mean, when we sold our company, we had 250 people. Wow. When you have so many people, you have to have good process. You can be kind of loose and lax, obviously, if it's just one person, you know, like every process is ad hoc. A couple people, it could still be pretty ad hoc. But when you start getting like 50 people, I mean, I remember that was like a big, you know, milestone. When we hit like 45 or 50 people, that was like a big, like, okay, like all your processes really need to be professional at that point to get any further.
It's cool to recognize that. What were some of the other milestones on that growth journey? Because ultimately you sold out at the age of 39, but what were some of the standout milestones along that journey to an exit?
Yeah, so we were growing in the law enforcement, intelligence, military intelligence, defense community really quickly. And we won a bunch of awards. We won the FBI Director's Award for Outstanding Scientific Advancement. We were on the Inc. 500 list three times. I think number 61 on the list, kind of at our fastest growth point.
For those in the UK, that's just recognizing that you're one of the 500 fastest growing companies in the US in that year?
Correct.
Pretty special then.
Yeah, I mean, we were growing. I mean, I remember interviewing people and I would say, hey, you know what's cool is like, you're going to be more senior than like half the people in the company next year if you join today. You know, like when you're growing quickly and like doubling, it's a wonderful feeling. It's like the opposite of that terrible feeling where you hear like companies are going through like reduction in staff and everybody's got kind of a, you know, glum attitude, and it's, you know, but when you're growing like a rocket, like it's like manna from heaven, everything is good. But yeah, we hit a bunch of milestones. And you know, one of the milestones that really, let me tell you, an early milestone was we were stuck at like 14 or 15 developers at one point for a long time. We kind of have these like plateau points. And the reason was I was micromanaging all the code, right? So because I was a really, really good software developer, I would walk around this big table with everybody working on it. And I would look at their screens and I would say, no, you should do it this way. Okay, I'm going to rewrite that, like move over. Let me take that over. And so we couldn't functionally like grow because I was like a major bottleneck. And at one point, you know, Lila and I talked and she's like, you've got to like have someone else, you know, do this. And so I kind of made the announcement to the team, like, I'm not writing any more code. I'll be here if you need me, but like, I got to go spend time with customers. And everybody was shocked. They're like, are you kidding me? But when I did that, like we took off. And the reason is like, you know, we hired smarter people than I was, more competent people. And we didn't have a bottleneck of like a single person anymore. Another major milestone is when we started to win very large contracts. So we went from kind of one-off contracts to these multi-year contracts, you know, kind of billion-dollar ceiling IDIQ, so indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity, kind of, you know, where customers could come to us and say, you know, could you develop this under this contract? And, you know, at one point, kind of for one of our largest bids, we went head to head with Lockheed Martin, so the largest defense contractor in the world. And we personally spent $1 million on a single bid, like just the proposal, the paper proposal, like writing it, producing it, editing it, doing all the kind of research required for the solution that we were proposing. And so when you start getting into like $1 million on a single proposal, like
just to quote for something, it's a huge investment.
Huge investment, huge roll of the dice on that one. And when we won that, I mean, it was crazy because I talked to a bunch of the companies you'd recognize, like General Dynamics, BAE, you know, and I said, hey, do you guys want to partner with us? And everyone said, hell no, like you're going to get crushed by Lockheed Martin. Like they're unbeatable. And then of course, when we won, it was like, hey buddy, you know, any room for old General Dynamics on the team there?
First they laugh and then they ask for a favor. Yeah. It's, or mm-hmm. they ask how it's, it's often the case. What ultimately led to you being acquired by SR International then in UX thing?
Yeah. So really what happened is after 9/11, Lila and I were personally super invested in the mission. You know, we had this important mission where it was like our country's been attacked. We're going to go after the bad guys. We're going to send people all around the world to, you know, deploy our products in places like Afghanistan, Iraq. And the people we were working with were just focused on a mission. Like we have to do X. You know, we've got to break this code. We have to, whatever it was, like you just had like this mission and it was exciting. It was personally rewarding and exciting to do it. And then what started to happen is these things kind of dragged on for much too long, in my opinion. For example, our presence in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the mission started to get very bureaucratic, and you know, you'd start talking to a lot of lawyers and kind of accounting type people, and just not the special agent or the operator that was doing the mission. It was a lot more kind of administrative people. And at some point we were both just like, the fire has like died. You know, we are spending our time on a lot of really unrewarding tasks. And at that point, we're just like, we need to sell to a larger company that has a lot of these, you know, like the company we sold to, SR International, they were small in terms of a publicly traded company, but they were $2 billion market cap. They had, you know, in-house legal counsel. They had tons of contract support people. You know, they had all those things and they were qualified people that could do that and like doing it. And so that's why we were just, you know, we're like, if the love affair is over, like you've got to move on is kind of
recognizing that's so powerful though, because given that you and Lyle have built the business from scratch to this behemoth of 250 employees, huge contracts, huge revenue and profit, there's an understanding that you would have an emotional attachment to that business. So to emotionally understand that you were becoming detached from the work that you were doing and the contracts, it takes a real level of self-awareness to painfully maybe remove yourself from something that is ultimately, literally, based on it being a husband and wife team, your baby.
It is. And, you know, I was warned by people who had sold their businesses, you know, hey, when you sell your company, like this is what's going to happen after that. You're going to feel, you know, depressed, isolated. You're going to feel like you've lost something. And I was just like, you guys are crazy. You know, I just didn't believe it. And after I sold the company, I went to lunch with a friend who had sold his company. And he's like, I'm going to, you know, I was past kind of the book of wisdom when I sold my company and everything in the book of wisdom happened. Now I'm passing it to you. And he told me all this stuff. He warned me about, like, you know, the every day is Saturday syndrome, where once you are kind of out of the company and you have all the money that you need and you don't have, you know, to go in and work these crazy hours anymore, you have all these hours that are suddenly available. And, you know, Saturday feels great one day, 2 day, 3 day, a week, 2 weeks, three, but, you know, pretty soon you're kind of like, okay, all my friends are at work right now. You know, it's a Wednesday at, you know, 11 a.m. Like what do I do? You know? And so there were times where I told Lila, I would give every penny back if we could just get the company back. Like I was very depressed for a while. And so now when other people exit, I pass the book of wisdom. I'm like, we got to have lunch because I'm going to tell you a bunch of things. You're not going to believe this, but it's true. And these things are going to happen and you need to be ready for them. You know,
psychologically, it's understandable because you put so much into the building phase. Once that's been achieved and there's the success of the exit, the financial freedom off the back of it that you've managed to attain, there's that gold medal syndrome that people talk about after the Olympics. Somebody wins that medal they've worked towards for 4 years, probably more than that in terms of their actual training career. And then when that high has been had and maybe they retire from the sport or you retire from business, oh my goodness, like how do you fill your times? Like you say, Saturday can be fun for a little while, but based on your personality type and the drive and the anger and the anxiety you spoke about throughout your early years, that's probably still there somewhere. It needs to be channeled and it can't just be left to fester in the background, because that's when you do see founders fall into a deep depression, they become suicidal, things break up, like the marriages that have been stable throughout their career. Exactly. They're seeking that other high. So it doesn't surprise me that when you were told that, you maybe didn't initially believe, but it quite quickly became a reality because of how you're wired and how you got to where you got to. So where did you start to allocate your energy instead?
Yeah. So, I mean, the first thing I did when I was feeling that way is I went to Nepal for a month and climbed a mountain. And, you know, when I got back, I was like, okay, I need to get back into business. I don't want to have 250 employees anymore. That was a lot. You know, other people can manage people, I think, a lot more effectively than I can. But I was like, I really want to get into kind of cool companies that have really neat challenges and But just not like at the people scale that I was before. So I got into investing in startups, helping mentor those startups, and buying and operating entire companies. For example, Total Shield, I have the shirt on, is a niche company that provides ballistic and explosive shielding mainly to space companies, which fits the bill, right? We have 7 employees, so smaller company, but we get to work with, you know, SpaceX, Blue Origin, Rocket Lab, Northrop Grumman. I mean, just cool companies on really interesting things. And that's kind of what I did.
From a angel investing or an acquisition perspective, what are some of the qualities that you look for? You say you don't want a behemoth in terms of lots of management, but what else stands out?
Yeah. So there's two things. If I'm buying an operating company, what I look for are monopolies nobody gives a shit about. I want a company that you've never even heard of, like the subject matter. You don't care about it. You're not interested in competing with it. But when you need that thing, you're willing to kind of pay a premium for it because there's only so many providers that can do it. So either they have very specialized intellectual property, patents, just moats, right? Expertise moats. People, just, you know, how many people can do, for example, the high energy calculations that we do in Total Shield to protect something from like a rocket motor blast. If I'm investing in a startup, I've invested in a lot of software, tech, energy, defense. And I've had a couple major wins and a bunch that went to zero. And I've kind of learned a lot on that side. Those I look more for the founder. I really, really want to get a good feel for the founders and understand their drive, their level of dedication. And when I feel good about that, I've tended to have really good outcomes in investing. And when what I didn't feel good about within, that, they've not been good.
What traits within the founder are the most important for you?
So I think founders that are, there's a couple things. One, I want to see a founder that can sell, because a founder generally is the face of the company and they need to represent the company well. So I want to see some sort of ability to kind of interact with partners, customers, confidently. I want to see a drive and a fire and a dedication like what I felt, which is just like, this is going to be a success. I really get turned off when I hear founders who are like, yeah, we're going to give this a try. And, you know, if it worked, you know, it's like, hey, hold on. Like, I want to hear that, you know, this is going to be a success because you're going to do everything it takes to make this a success.
Certainty is really attractive to spend time around. They're people that you want to get behind as well.
Exactly. And, I just kind of feel like someone who is creative enough to pivot and find a successful path. I mean, starting a new company is really hard because you've got to have so many things that go right. You've got to have the right product, the right message, the right market fit, the right customer acquisition strategy. And sometimes, most of the time, one of those things isn't quite right. But your successful founders kind of pivot and find something. It may look very different from the original thing they sold me as an investor. But like, I'm happy because they found a way to be successful.
Well, in the same way, your original plan for Platinum Solutions was not to be working with secret agencies on their software for how they transfer evidence or how they respond to the war on terror.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's one of the, you know, I talk to a lot of founders and entrepreneurs and they say like, what should I do? And one of the things I say is, well, you should get lucky, you should, whatever you decide to do, it's probably not going to look the way you think it will at the end. Some luck is going to be involved. Some random occurrences are going to come to play. And also the founder is going to be kind of observant enough to recognize it and kind of follow it, you know?
Speaking of traits and some of the characteristics around entrepreneurs, I took down one of your tweets when you were speaking about the regrets and wishes that you've learned from a lot of different entrepreneurs through some of the groups that you're part of, so the Entrepreneurs Organization for Starters. And the start of that tweet is, all anyone ever talks about is health, marriage, family, because that's all that fucking matters. What prompted you to write that?
Yeah, so I'm in a couple different groups that are all entrepreneur founders who some have had billion-dollar exits, some have built companies you would have heard of, major brands, and others, you know, have had smaller companies, but, you know, successful in their areas. And when we get together, you know, I have a call every week with a founders group. I used to be in a forum, an entrepreneurs organization, which were all founders. And nobody talks about business, right? It's like, yeah, boring, you know, forget about that. Like, I've got major problems in my marriage and I need to talk to someone about it. It's a very lonely world when you are kind of a, you know, the leader of the company, right? You can't pull aside an employee and say, hey, I really have major like health problems and I need to get myself straight, or like, I'm going to die. You know, like those are the types of decisions, or I mean, the types of discussions that you hear, you know, kind of behind closed doors. And the reason is, like, you know, you always think about like what's important on your deathbed, you know, my family, my wife, my kids, my relationship with my parents or extended family. You know, these are the things that are really, really important and can really be imperiled when you're driving and working towards that, like, you know, building a company.
The North Star, all that matters. Like, some other things can get put on the back burner. And you spoke about propping the eyes open for 20 plus hours. Health was clearly in the back burner for a period for you from that perspective.
Yeah, I would say I got pretty lucky. You know, I've had, I think stress is the ultimate health killer however it manifests, either, you know, digestive issues, cancers, obesity, you know, people overeat because they're stressed, whatever it is, like, stress will put you in your grave faster than anything else I know. And when you're dealing with that kind of stress, you know, for me, it was just like, well, work through it. Like, I got to work harder. I got to work more. Forget that. Like, you know, I would work 20 hours. I would come home. I would drink a beer. Everybody would be asleep. I would take a shower, go to sleep, and then like wake up at 4 a.m. or, you know, early in the morning, go back to work. And, you know, you can't sustain that type of life, right? I mean, something's going to break. And I would have weird stress-related things. Like, I had shingles, like at age like 30, like in my face. I was like, what is this? And the doctor's like, yeah, usually that happens to a much older person. Like, are you under stress? And I was like, yeah, I'm under.
And I'm biologically, under, like, how much stress you would have been aging faster. Yeah, completely understand. It's a really important recognition. And a lot of the time, sometimes people say it when they're out of it, but given that you get to speak to entrepreneurs who are in the thick of it with your experience, and quite often you are like basically a partner with them within their business, it is paying for them to listen for that in terms of, oh, well, Adam's been there and done it, and he said that prioritizing health might be a good idea instead of just the pure graft mode, because there's got to be hard work. Like, nobody should ever shy away from that, but your recognition that if you want longevity in the game, there's an element of, let's look after yourself too.
I nag the hell out of entrepreneurs and founders that I invest with and work with. I'm just like, are you getting into the gym? Like, tell me what you ate today. When did you eat? You know, it's weird because you'd think like an investor would be like, I want you to work harder. And usually I'm like, I want you to be working less. Like, you can't, you know, this is too important for you to just say like, I'll get into the gym in a couple years when we've reached this point. Like, I don't want to hear that. Because of all the health issues that I've seen come up with my friends, I've also seen them ruin their marriages, which like the level of divorce kind of in my cohort is way higher than even the level of which already I think like in society is very high.
It's much higher now. It's around 50%.
Yeah. Our cohort is above 50% because it's so hard on marriages. It's so hard on relationship with kids. And yeah, so I'm just kind of like, if I had worked less, we would have been just fine. We maybe, you know, the company would have taken another year to sell, but like, who cares? You know, like in retrospect, I don't want to see people do what I did because I got lucky that I'm still in good health, but the ball could have easily bounced the wrong way.
Yeah, it's a huge realization. And like you say, your health and your marriage being intact at the time of exit is really healthy because the life that you've gone on to live is fantastic in terms of for breaking the wall with the listeners. You're living off grid, you're on a huge farm and really enjoying the fruits of your labor now in terms of being able to do the things that you like to do with these businesses, but also living in an environment that taps into your other interests too.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the luckiest guy in the world. And so what's funny with me is like if someone's trying to schedule something, I'm like, well, if the weather's good, I can't do it. But if it's going to be like rainy, like I could probably be there, you know, because I'm like very outdoor oriented. You know, we're managing 550 acres of forest land. We have a giant orchard. We keep bees. We are out kayaking, fishing. You know, it's kind of a nature based lifestyle that we've just kind of brought our kids up in. And, you know, like one, I was on a call with some customer and my wife was like, hey, the bees just swarmed, meaning like they flew out of the hive and they collected on like a tree branch. She's like, you got to come, you know, like capture this hive. And so I was like, oh, I'm sorry. I know this is very abrupt, but like I have to leave right now. And someone was like, why? And it's like, well, I have to capture a beehive. It's like, this is just the way I choose to live now. And I'm super fortunate to be able to live like this. I mean, I know how fortunate and lucky I am. And it's an absolute blessing.
That level of gratitude is so important though, because if you contrast that to the founders that exit and just stumble from one thing to the next in terms of trying to find some sort of purpose again in life, you taking on a project like your 500-acre farm makes total sense based on how you're wired as well, because you don't want the every day to be Saturday whatsoever.
Yeah, and you know, there's one of the things that I've seen from a lot of my successful kind of friends is a very conscious focus on gratitude, writing down things they're thankful for, expressing it often. And I think that's very, very, very important because no matter what your kind of level of achievement is, I've seen people who say, I'm depressed because I don't have what that person has. You know, the thief is the comparison of joy is so true. And if you can just stop and say like, hey, I'm really thankful for what I have, I do it every day. I'm thankful for my wife, my kids, my lifestyle, my companies, everything. I'm super thankful.
I think it comes across in your energy though, Adam. And when I look at how you hold yourself and how you conduct yourself and the way that you're trying to give back to these younger founders, I think you're living a very aligned life as well. And post-exit, it's almost freed up all this bandwidth that you've just allocated in ways that you're really comfortable with. And in contrast to those latter days where you're like, I don't like this contract, I don't like the work that we're doing.
Yeah.
Let's get out of it.
Yeah. I mean, that's another thing that, you know, I always say the world belongs to the young. And I wish I had had kind of more mentors. It just wasn't, I just didn't have a very good network when I started my company. I was able to network through things like EO with, or at the time it was called YEO, with other people who were kind of my age, but we were all kind of like babies in business, you know, like we didn't really know a whole lot. So I'm trying to be that person that has been through a lot of this that people can talk to. And I'm open to, you know, people reaching out to me on Twitter, X, on LinkedIn, you know, that have questions about just how do you start a business? How do you, you know, how do you deal with these things? Because I think it's our obligation, if you've made it to some degree, like you've got to give back to younger people.
Passing on the baton, I think it's a really noble thing to do. And I think the listeners will have taken tremendous value from this conversation, and they'll certainly want to continue the conversation with you. Where should they head towards in terms of LinkedIn and X? Where are they?
Yeah, so on X, I am at Rossi Adam. On LinkedIn, just search for Adam Rossi. And yeah, those are the two best places.
Beautiful, Adam. Both of those will be linked in the show notes. Thank you so much to you. And thank you to you, the listener. I'll be back to speak to you all again very, very soon.